On July 25th, Republic Day in Tunisia, non-partisan protests erupted in various cities, calling for the dismissal of the government and corrupt political parties that have been stalling progress in parliament and failed to address the COVID-19 crisis adequately. That night, President Kais Saied invoked Article 80 of the Tunisian Constitution that allows him to implement exceptional measures in the event of imminent danger threatening the nation's institutions or the security or independence of the country and hampering the normal functioning of the state, quoting the Constitution. These exceptional measures included the dismissal of the head of government, Hichem Mishishi, the suspension of parliament and lifting immunity of all parliamentary representatives. Many Tunisians took to the streets and celebrated the announcement with song and dance, while others were rather skeptical. We have invited three Tunisians to discuss what happened and how they perceived the events: Bilqis Anan, Haytham Gasmi, and Habib Sayeh. Welcome to the Activism Academy podcast. I am your host, Hela Grishi, Activism Academy lead and junior researcher within the Khalifa Ehler Institute. This podcast is recorded 12 days after the events that took place on Republic Day in Tunisia. Our panel is composed of three Tunisians from different backgrounds. Before we delve into the core matter, I'd like to invite our guests to introduce themselves. Bilqis Anan, would you like to start?
Yes, thank you. Sorry, I was on mute. I'm Bilqis. I'm 25 years old. I'm a Tunisian. I currently live in Washington, D.C. I'm a mathematician by nature. I work as a product manager for machine learning at PwC, and I'm very interested in politics, especially in Tunisia and the region. I had a minor degree in MENA studies from Northwestern University, and closely always observe what's happening on the ground in Tunisia.
Welcome to this show, Bilqis, and thank you for your presence. And we also have Habib Sayeh with us. Would you like to introduce yourself as well?
Hello, I'm Tunisian, based in Tunis, 33 years old. I'm a consultant working with various Tunisian NGOs and international organizations on issues like security and justice reform, but also media development. Recently, I've been involved in research on polarization. I'm a lawyer by training, but I also have a degree in law studies, security being one of my interests.
Thank you, Habib Sayeh. And now, Haytham Gasmi, the floor is yours.
Thank you. My name is Haytham S. Gasmi. I'm an engineer in agriculture, especially in plants protection, with a thorough study of insects. When I got my diploma, I just discovered that I wasn't really interested in farmers, but rather in farming. So I work in research in agrarian politics and peasant struggles in civil society. So I was more interested in social sciences than in what we call exact science. And I have a podcast where I share some ideas about that. I'm considered as what we call the youth of the revolution. And I'm interested in how history shapes itself in transition periods.
That's very interesting. I would like to plug your podcast to ours so that other people who are listening to ours can also discover yours. But that's for the end. But for now, this episode is about what happened on the 25th of July in Tunisia, the events themselves, but also the consequences, projections, and sentiments of the Tunisian people, as well as all the factors that led up to this point. The narrative on a global scale has been snatched away from Tunisians and sabotaged by global think tankers and foreign experts looking at the events from a reductionist lens. To start off this podcast, my first question. We all remember the celebrations that took place after Kais Saied announced his exceptional measures. Our guests hold different opinions and interpretations about what happened on the 25th. So my first question to you is really simple. What was your initial reaction to the announcement? Where were you at that moment, and how did you feel? Please, Bilqis, I want to start with you.
Thank you, Hela. I remember when everything happened, it was a shock, to be honest. I wasn't following closely what was happening in Tunisia for the last few weeks. I was really focused on the health crisis. I was fundraising here in Washington, D.C. for oxygen concentrators. And then when it happened, it was shocking. I get a call from the embassy telling me they will cancel my event and my fundraising dinner because of everything happening back home. So I go and see what's happening. And I think I literally in my head, it was like, oh, Tunisia is going to be the next military power. I think about Assisi. I think about all these scenarios we've seen in other countries. And of course, my initial feeling was just total fear. I couldn't understand why people were dancing in the streets. But yeah, I would say that was my knee-jerk reaction.
Given this knee-jerk reaction, it's going to be really interesting how we go from sentiments to analysis later. But first, Habib Sayeh, what was your impression that day?
Well, first, I was one of the Tunisians on the ground who learned about it a bit later, because I was on a long phone call with my sister in Germany. I was using noise-canceling headphones, and I didn't hear anything. At some point, my sister asked me a question, and I had to look something up on Twitter to answer her. And then suddenly I see these tweets about a coup. I see videos of people in Mourouge dancing, chanting, and then I remove my headphones and I hear the same atmosphere in my street. So I went down and effectively so a similar scene where I live. It came as a bit of a surprise. There were events on that day that were calling for something as drastic as the measures Syed called for, implemented actually. But I don't think many of us were really expecting that to happen.
Thank you, Habib. And what about you, Haytham?
In fact, for me, for the day of the 25th, I had like a huge gambling game with my friends because I was expecting that. And I gathered all my friends in my house. And it was since like 6 p.m. And I told them tonight we will have like great measures from the president. And we were watching the news, and the presenter in the news, she was a bit stressed. And I was telling people who are my friends in my house, telling them that there is something that's going to happen. And you can go back to that that news of 25th and see what happened. Afterwards, we had like the Nahda press conference, and it was interrupted by Qais Saied. And then I was like, I won, I won the bet, and it was merely as I expected, because in fact it goes back 2 years ago that when Qais Saied was elected, I was a bit shocked, and I was like, I don't want things to happen suddenly anymore. So I did like a lot of history studies. And Qais Saied made me do it to a time where the last six months I was like researching and reading every single news about the region of the Arabic region or the Middle East and North Africa region until you have the 25K. So I felt like a bit shocked on how I could have predicted that. But afterwards, some fear came, and I was dealing with that during the whole night.
Each one of you has a very unique scenario. It's very fascinating. I did not expect any of these answers, so I'm glad we have this on tape.
I'm very curious to know, Haytham, what are maybe a few factors that made you expect that this will happen on that day, at least?
Yeah, the first thing that Qais Saied came with during his presidency is symbolism. the electoral campaign and everything he does was symbolic, even his handwriting and his messages and his speeches and everything. So 25th of July was one of the days where I expected he would do a move. It was the March 20th and the 20th for the independence, but the conditions weren't really messed up to a point that he takes that step. But afterwards, I did like a huge investigation about the people who are calling for the protests of 25th of July, and none were from like a campaign or a party or something like that. So I betted like there is something that's going to happen.
Thank you for sharing that.
That is really interesting to hear. So moving on to the next question. After the announcement and subsequent moves that were undertaken, like sacking certain ministers and arresting MPs who are no longer shielded by parliamentary immunity, you surely started to take a stance towards what is happening. Please elaborate on your stance and how you came to certain conclusions. Would you call the events a coup, not a coup, or an eventual coup, or something else altogether? Elkis?
Yes, thank you, Hela. So after my first reaction, a few hours later, I listened to people. I jumped on Clubhouse, was listening to what people were saying. Nobody was thinking it was a coup. Everyone was thinking he was doing the necessary to break down the parliament that was blocking a lot of the development people were waiting for. People were also very upset with the government. They were calling it Hukumat al-Maut, government of death. So to me, that was also a necessity that he dismisses the government. And then when I listened more to how these demands are just meaning popular demand, I started seeing it as a coup only in shape and form. After all, there are two components of a coup. There is the coup itself, that you dismiss the government and you take all power for yourself. And then there's the goal behind it, and mostly it's to take over the country. This is what people do, coups. And to me, Kais Saied did not seem like he would do that to take over the country. And this is, of course, based on just assumptions and speculations, and people's immense trust in him too. And the following days, as you said, when he lifted the immunity, we see the police arresting a few corrupt people. To me, it started to look more as an attempt to clean the corrupt political scene than to take power to himself. I felt it was like a necessary evil, maybe, and just describing it as a coup is not totally just because of the connotation of a coup and the image we have of what a coup does and why it happens. I felt like this is not why this coup happened. It's like there are people who demolish homes and there are people who like demolish a wall or two so they can rebuild it. And I felt maybe that analogy helps to understand why some of us are not so quick to conclusions. Of course, this could go down a dark path. We don't know what's to come. It could turn into a dictatorship. He has the power to turn it to. And really what we are clinging to is just the hope that he doesn't, which of course is not how countries should function. And that gives him a lot of freedom to turn into dictatorship or not. And we should not be waiting for him to choose not to. But I think Tunisians just chose to do that. And as a classic populist myself, I always just side with the people and think the people impacted most by events should know if events unfolding are good for them or not. And if everyone is happy and finally clinging to a ray of hope. And I heard an actor say, Lotfi Abdelli, that uncertainty with hope is better than uncertainty without hope. And to see, honestly, to see people from all different like walks of life and political affiliations, even people who voted for Nahda, my family themselves voted for Nahda before, and to see everyone happy, everyone on the same page for once, honestly, I haven't seen that since 2011. And to me, that was just a big sign that maybe we're doing something right.
Thank you so much, Bilqis. What about you, Habib?
First, I want to say well done to Haitham for having seen it coming and because I guess I observed many signs pointing to not necessarily that this was going to happen, but that this kind of action was the only option Saeed had if he wanted to realize his vision. But I didn't believe he would go that far, because in the last year since he became president, he exercised, I think, a lot of restraint. He had many occasions to at least dissolve parliament. Or at least he could have taken actions that would have facilitated that scenarios, and he didn't. But at the same time, this is a man who ran for president with a program aimed at dramatic changes to the system, to the constitution, but who didn't bother to have some representation on the legislative front. He didn't have a party. He didn't have any parliamentary bloc that could have adopted the measures necessary to revise the constitution. So his only option was either he could have blamed the political system for not having, not allowing him to realize his vision, or he could make it happen forcefully. And I think that's what he did. I believe his reading of Article 80, which he invoked to take his decisions, was far-fetched. That's the one of the first things I did. I reopened the constitutions and read it, and to me it didn't make constitutional sense for him to freeze parliament while the constitution says that these exceptional measures can only be taken when parliament is in permanent session. So due to this illegality, I believe it's safe to say that it's a coup, because he contradicted the conventional understandings of the constitution, and it resulted in a situation where he has all power to himself. There are no checks and balances, except maybe the street and pressure from civil society, but we're in a very dramatic kind of political situation. But it's not a traditional coup in the sense that he hasn't done what I was and most people expected him to do in the hours following his decisions. He did not pursue, prosecute or arrest his opponents. He, except for some incidents, the freedom of expression and press freedom haven't been touched. I mean, what kind of country has a coup and allows state-owned television to give a platform and amplify the voices of the political opponents who are crying it is a coup? So this label is, I think, accurate in a sense, but in another, from another point of view, it's not very helpful, because it doesn't say much about the nature of what's happening and what may come next.
These are very interesting points, and I'm excited to see the discussion that we are going to have about this point after Haitham Ghesmi will share with us what he thinks.
Yeah, sure. In fact, when these measures, let's call them neutrally measures, that have happened since 25th of July, the first question, which is the normal question and the legitimate question, is this a coup or not? The problem here is that answers are not normal and are not really easy. Because first of all, when we go to the history of coups, we are used to, especially in the 20th century, of military coups and some exceptions of police coups, like in Tunisia with Ben Ali. But what makes them all similar is that the coup comes from below to above in a way that there's, for example, the military apparatus. It does a coup against the leader of these military, which is the president of the republic. But what happened here in Tunisia is that the supreme leader took the power, which technically he doesn't really need to take it. The other question is it a coup to what? Is it a coup against what? Is it against the so-called fake democratic transition that we had during these 6 years? Because finally, if we can say that Kais Saied might be a dictator, and I'm not really dismissing this point, but it needs to be to have like a deep reflection on this possibility. If he would be a dictator, so he is defined by having all the powers under his hand. But there's a question: how was the power shared in the state? Did we have really a shared power between like the legislative and the juridical and the executive powers and authorities in Tunisia? No, we didn't have that. We just had like small cartels where everybody is fighting against everybody, and we had always like a biased analysis and a biased judgment. So what I think happened in Tunisia, in the point of view of the discussions that happened during these like 10 days, I guess, is that in Tunisia, sociologically speaking, and a bit in Algeria also, we have like a mental bureaucracy. Let me explain this. In fact, we have like a huge heritage of bureaucracy that came first from the Ottoman Empire, which is the empire that invented bureaucracy. And afterwards, we had it from the French colonization. We really believe in the text. We always idolize text. And I don't want to be like a bit harsh, but also the kind of Islam that we have in Tunisia, which is the Maliki and Ash'ari Islam, idealizes a lot the text. And we have like a lot of explanations of the main text without producing new texts. So this technocracy made us believe that this is a coup on the 18th article of the constitution and things like that. This is from an interior point of view. In the exterior point of view, in the history of coups, all coup leaders need to have the support of other countries, which is the geopolitical aspect of it, that like we need to be, the coup needs to be recognized at least from some countries. And that's what happened, for example, in Africa, what happened in South America, where we had coups that are backed by the US. But in Tunisia, we don't really have like these allies who can back up this coup. Even Egypt, which is living under a military coup, it's a clear military coup, didn't really go on full support of what's happening in Tunisia. And that's another problem, which because the relationship between Tunisia and Egypt is solely on security measures and terrorism and things like that. So for me, finally, why I have like a small ray of hope, it was built just after the meeting with the UTICA, the Union of Industry, and which we call the Union of Bosses, the Syndicate of Bosses in Tunisia. When the president had the meeting with the head of this union, there I understood that there's some hope for a change in Tunisia. Kais Saied is not really the Thomas Sankara, or this is at least my political beliefs. He's not the Thomas Sankara, he's not the Fidel Castro, he's not the Jamal Abdel Nasser, the real coups that really changed the courses of countries. like in Abd al-Nasser, he did it against the monarchy in Cuba. Fidel Castro did it against American imperialism, etc., etc. But at least Qais Saied is working on some interior growth. He's trying to build what we historically call the national bourgeoisie. The national bourgeoisie only works, they are capitalists, we know that, but they work first to the development, the interior development of their country. In Tunisia, we haven't ever had a national bourgeoisie. All our capitalists were compradors who have like a lot of relationships and interests in the exterior than the interior. So that's what Qais Saied, at least, which is the least he can do, and the least the smallest hope that we can have from him.
For our international listeners, it would be really interesting to develop this point quickly. What did he say to the leader of Utica and what happened? Because I know, but I want to hear from you.
So, yeah, this is an important meeting because, as I told you, first of all, there's always the symbolism of Qais Saied. If history will put Qais Saied's name in our textbooks or in any other thing, it's going to be about symbolism. That's the only legacy that he would have. So the first thing is symbolism here when he did a head-to-head, one-to-one meeting only with the head of this union. He didn't have like before. Huh? He didn't have one-on-one meetings with other heads. He did like a group discussions and meetings, but with Mejoul, the Utica head, he was alone and he didn't speak, he didn't answer. So this is the first thing, which is symbolism. The second thing is the announcement that the businessmen who were corrupt during the Ben Ali era and who took a lot of loans from local banks and invested their money in foreign banks, especially in Europe and in fiscal havens. He asked them, with the power of the law that he gave, which is a suggestion from him since 2011, which is that the most corrupt businessman takes care and develops and does like infrastructure projects in the most poor, in the poorest region in Tunisia. So it was like a proposition on national TV and on Facebook, saying that the people are watching you, and I gave you an offer you can't refuse. Else, these businessmen will go to jail. So this was the whole summary of the meeting.
It is also interesting to know that this deal would allow them to walk free after 10 years, if I'm not mistaken. And I remember also seeing a lot of reactions from people who are still angry, people from the movement Menishim Semah. We are not forgiving them. And the opinions on this are really divided. It's a very interesting debate. So do you have anything that you want to discuss or questions amongst yourselves?
Just excuse me, I need just to add that I'm from Menishim Semah. So even in Menishim Semah, we don't have like a consensus about what Qais Saied is proposing.
Even better. Makes sense. All of it makes sense. So the floor is yours.
I was also at Menishim Semah at some point. That's actually where I met Haytham back in 2017. And I've seen different reactions. In all honesty, I don't fully grasp the detailed plan of Qais Saied or how it differs from the reconciliation law we passed already. I feel like him matching the richest people to the poorest areas a little, it wouldn't make a lot of sense to have someone who owes millions and millions go into like a small area and someone who owes a few millions go into another small area. Of course, a lot of money is needed for infrastructure, but I feel like it should be unified in one. There should be one centralized fund that would work on everything altogether. than just allocating villages and areas to certain people to be like fully under their control. And yeah, but I mean, I wouldn't go into the detail of that because I haven't, I just genuinely did not really pay a lot of attention to what he proposed besides this like superficial point.
I was a bit surprised with his exclusive focus on pre-revolution corruption. He has a plan for Ben Ali era corrupt business people to pay or be prosecuted, but I'm really curious about what he intends to do with those who are responsible for post-revolution corruption, because the revolution established some form of facade democracy, but corruption is still endemic. In most people's perception, it has actually increased. And I suppose he intends to do something about it. And I'm really looking forward to understanding what he intends to do and how this is going to work, especially in terms of the judicial treatment of this post 2011 corruption, because the judicial itself is corrupt and rather out of control. But Qais Saied claims that he intends to respect his opponent's right to a fair trial, and so I'm expecting some creative solution to this problem.
Thank you for this fruitful discussion. Honestly, I have no idea as well, and I am really eager to see how this is going to unfold. But moving on to our next question, after a few intense days of assimilating what happened, all of you surely encountered a lot of narratives about what happened in your country, even from people who are not familiar with the political, economic, and social landscape in Tunisia. What were your experiences on social media or with fellow Tunisians as well as with foreigners pitching in? Bilqis, would you like to start?
Yes, thank you, Hela. I think this was like most what I mostly focus on in the last few days, which I think wasn't really a good idea. But I was surprised at the amount of misinformation I saw online. And I try to fight that because I believe in people's right to write their own story and not have their story written for them. I believe we should be talked to and not talked over. And but I also understand the outsider reaction. I think it's due to a lot of factors. Tunisia has often been pigeonholed with the rest of the region. So when you talk Middle East, a lot of people tend to think history is just repeating itself in our countries. I've seen that firsthand when I had a minor degree in MENA studies at Northwestern, and in any big school in the US, you would find these fancy MENA degrees, but at the bottom of it really is just a lot of research on Egypt and Syria and on countries that are like appealing and interesting to the Western eye. So my Middle Eastern and North Africa studies degree was really just Egypt and Syria studies by professors who spent 6 months in Egypt at some point, with students who go on exchange programs in Egypt. So literally it was like an Egyptology course. And I raise that point a lot of times. And whenever I meet MENA experts in the US, I tend to like voice out how uncomfortable I feel with their speculations on the region, and especially North Africa. But now we see that firsthand with being associated with Egypt the whole time. While we have very different political models, we have very different problems, different constitution, our military is not as politicized as Egypt. So I think the comparisons being made are not new. They've been there forever. It's just that for the first time, we see them and they bother us. Other than that, I think there's just a big speculation on Tunisians just having ideological fights. I think Tunisia had that in the past. maybe the first 5 years of the last decade, we've had a lot of ideological divide, but I think we evolved from that, and even our Islamic party started as a, like, stopped associating themselves so much with the Islamic label and moved on to different labels, and for them to assume those are the only conflicts we could have is really reeks of Orientalism and just Western supremacy, really. Like, we're not allowed to have maybe fights that are on corruption, on economy. We're really just a bunch of people who are not able to figure out what their ideology is, and it's just a secular minority trying to control the country over an Islamic majority. And it's all these really laughable scenarios that I think unveil a lot of the Orientalism and the Western supremacy in seeing us and our capabilities and capacities of thinking and of the quality of conflicts we could have. This is definitely elevates a lot from just a basic ideological fight, and to be reduced to that the whole time was really hurtful to see Tunisians judge the whole time. But I think just the lack of research and the confirmation bias too, when you have this idea of a people in your head and you really think this is a coup against Muslims or a coup against democracy, you really pick on every detail to confirm that bias you already have. So every arrest, every announcement he makes, the media finds a way to turn it into a validation of the coup. I don't think if they've been following all the arrests we have and how the police treats us or how the police functions in mysterious ways. And I've never seen Tunisian police really knocking on doors and gently handcuffing people away. They really just barge in and take people. And I've experienced that firsthand. Protesters have had a lot of police violence, but now suddenly that's a problem. And that's just validation that Qais Saied is issuing all these orders. And I feel like it just takes a lot of audacity to come and use scenarios that we are impacted by and victimized by against us. Like, you don't get to tell us what is wrong and what is not wrong. We've been living that forever. And I think they just basically lost touch since 2019. Western experts maybe, I've seen a lot of people not understand what happened, how people elected Qais Saied. And I think they just stopped following Tunisian developments since then. And they've totally lost touch, and they went back to the comfortable ideas they had since the ideological fights we had in 2014, because just that's easier to talk about.
Very interesting word is MENA expert. How are you an expert on so many countries? Thank you for your intervention, Habib. What is your experience?
Like many other Tunisians, I had a problem with the way the Tunisia events were being framed by foreign actors on social media, academia, traditional media, not only Western actors but other actors from the region, from neighboring countries. As I said earlier, I believe it's okay to say this is a coup, although it's not a traditional coup, and the label the validity of this label doesn't say much about what it might entail. So I won't blame anyone, Tunisian or foreign, for calling it a coup. However, as I think Balqis said earlier, this term has a lot of connotations. These connotation might be related, I think, to the fact that many so-called MENA experts don't know much about the country and tend to conflate or lump together different countries in the region and make analogies which are unfounded and unhelpful. The labeling, saying this is a coup, and especially if it's backed by a misunderstanding or a misinterpretation of what's actually going on and what may happen, this framing is not simply a choice of vocabulary. It can have real world consequences because reality is discursively constructed, especially when those who use that word have some influence on policy. And I'm talking about some Western academics and think tankers and journalists who are actually listened to by policymakers. And the narratives some of these have been pushing since the 25th are really unhelpful in the sense that they exaggerate, I think, what's going on or compare it to other contexts like Egypt. And these narratives imply that the West has some responsibility to take for what's happening in Tunisia and should intervene in a way or another to correct our course. Some people have called for withdrawing vaccine donations to Tunisia. Others have called for boots on the ground. And I think this is really what's most disturbing. Because if history has taught us anything, it's the damages even well-intended foreign meddling can do. And we have Libya, our neighboring country, which can testify to that. Watching the narratives has been really frustrating, because these narratives can have real-world consequences on Tunisia by inviting unwanted interference. And at the same time, we are many of us are confident that whether we're happy with what happened or not, we can deal with it on our own internally. And there's also the issue of disinformation that's been prolific. False framings of certain events, for example, think tankers who claim that Qais Saied has dissolved parliament when he actually hasn't. He froze parliament. I mean these nuances have some importance, but also more nefarious types of disinformation, claiming, for example, that the coup was orchestrated by Egyptian intelligence officers dispatched by Sisi. And that they even beat Prime Minister Mishishi on the night of the coup. These can be really damaging internally and externally, and they're the result of a growing network of disinformation outlets targeting Tunisia for years now, mostly piloted by regional hegemons, notably Turkey and Qatar, but also the UAE, who have a different stance on what happened on the 25th. But there's a narrative warfare that's playing out in the Tunisian media space. And it isn't about democracy. It isn't about the interests of the Tunisian people. It is about the rivalries and the geopolitical interests of regions which have, of countries which have expansionist ambitions that happen to target Tunisia and its neighbor Libya. And it's been really sad to see some Tunisians serve as useful idiots for these propaganda or influence operations, and side with once amplify this disinformation.
A lot of the things that I've seen, they were really shocking, and it was not just people saying things in a vacuum or giving their opinion, but as you said, they affect the real lives of Tunisians. Haytham, what about you?
In fact, what we were assisting, what we were seeing during like the last 10 or 15 years that we had like a lot of technology that makes information so viral in a way that we lately we are speaking about the limits of freedom of speech and how fake news considered as a freedom of speech or something. But for me, I think this question was answered for like 100 years ago. There was a wise man who said once, no investigation, no right to speak. In fact, there's a huge problem. It's not the problem of the speech and it's not the problem of the freedom, but it's the problem of the intentions, sorry, and the fact that we are dealing with neutral, supposedly neutral persons and neutral technologies, and in a way that there are no intentions, there are no interests, there are no, everybody is rational, everybody is responsible, etc. The sequence of modernism. So what I noticed lately is there was like a form of laziness. In a way, as Balqis said, everybody is going back to the easy narrative, to the narrative that doesn't really need research, doesn't really need efforts to analyze and speak about. I make a small difference here, but it's not really that important. It's the difference between people, like normal people, plain people, and media. Media is based on propaganda and it's based on interests and it's based on that. But what's really shocking and scary is that people are recreating and are sharing a lot of media information without any effort to just double check it or just to verify. It's a sign of despair, or of I don't want to speak big, but it's a sign of depression in a way that every information that goes with my feelings are true. So there is no effort to challenge it. And that's why depressive people, for example, they go deeper in negative thoughts and things like that, because it goes with their feelings. It's not really the truth, but it suits their feelings. So finally, we are having like a lot of people who are saying that they are experts in MENA. What MENA? Is it Mauritania, Oman, the Zionist entity, Jordania, South Sudan? What MENA? Because, okay, for me, I believe in some form of unity, some form of historical blocks, some form of regional geopolitical side-to-side blocks. But no, it's us who decide to be in a block. It's not the academia or the imperialist taxonomy that names the regions. It's I don't really feel like I'm a citizen of the MENA region, or I didn't really meet people who think they are people of the MENA region, or they feel like some recognition from other countries. So finally, I think this expertise is the consequence of this laziness, of this mental laziness, which spreads like a meme. I refer to the word meme here to its biological meaning, which was defined by Richard Dawkins, I think. And it's about how some behavior spreads in the same in the same species without any genetical transformation, no DNA transformation. It's a behavior that when everybody's lazy, it's okay to be lazy, and it's okay to believe in fake news, and it's okay to spread fake news, and it's all in the interest of the geopolitical powers.
These are very interesting angles that you all took. If you have no further questions, I would move on to the next point.
Just one remark. We've been talking a lot about MENA experts, I mean, self-styled MENA experts, but there are even some academics and think tankers who claim expertise on a narrower field, which is Tunisia, people who have written PhD dissertations and books about Tunisia, not the whole region. And even those sometimes do not really have expertise. What I'm seeing more and more is some of these Tunisia experts who do not behave or think like academics, who are not here to understand, but who behave like activists, taking sides in Tunisian affairs and being obnoxious with what they feel are their opponents and promoting a narrower, promoting some narratives which are very Tunisian, but which are not necessarily objective or neutral. And we should be cautious with these Tunisia experts as well.
Definitely, that's a great point there. I encountered some of those myself, and it is just really ironical sometimes when I see what they write and no primary sources in Arabic or Tunisian, and it's just very detached. And as a Tunisian myself, I feel violated that my narrative is being taken away by someone who sees this as a career or as a niche for them, but at the end of the day, who is going to suffer and who is going to live with the consequences? And this is also a question that we should all always ask ourselves whenever we see a certain status or a narrative being built. Moving on to our last question. Democracy is often presented as a model that takes a certain form, and the path to attaining it is painted as being one linear road, according to various foreign analysts. Qais Saied, for example, is in favor of a whole new system based on locally elected councils voting for regional representatives rather than national parliamentary representatives. Whether you agree with him or not, what does democracy mean to you in light of all that happened, and do you believe that switching to another system is a better option? This time I would like to start with you, Habib.
I think to answer this question, we need to determine whether the previous system, the post-2014 system, in Tunisia was really a democracy, and whether it's enough to be a democracy. And I think the answer is no. A lot of people who are against Saied's decisions and who call this a coup are calling for a return to the previous system, including foreign powers who have called for the restoration of constitutional order. But even though I'm worried about the possibility that this side might take us in the wrong direction, a more authoritarian system, I don't think that's his intention. But the events and some pressures might lead him to concentrate power more permanently. A return to the previous system is not viable because it was only a facade democracy. It's based on a constitution whose authors didn't even bother to comply with. A parliament that has failed to establish a constitutional court, which would have been the only bulwark against Saied's move. I see people complaining that the military justice is prosecuting or arresting people after the 25th, but these same people were silent when Parliament abstained from adopting laws that would have prevented that. And there were calls, popular calls, for these practices to end. The previous system, it was ineffectual. The parliament has failed to fulfill its most basic functions. It has failed to hold the government to account, and it has even failed to as a lawmaking body. One of the most fascinating things about the last period is that the overwhelming majority of laws adopted in Parliament are actually ratifications of international treaties, most of which are loans. What Parliament should we restore? It hasn't been able to legislate at all. The previous system, yes, it was democratic in the sense that there were free and relatively fair elections. But I think there are things that are more important than procedural democracy. And you cannot really call yourself a democracy when you haven't engaged in security sector reform, justice reform, and abolished some of the old regime laws, which are restrictive of human rights and liberties. What they call a democracy is a system that's marked by endemic corruption, including in the judiciary. Therefore, there is no rule of law. That's marked also by police impunity and brutality, which isn't something that happens sometimes. It's routine. People are routinely tortured in Tunisia for common law crimes or even suspicions after this revolution, after the adoption of this constitution, which was hailed by the international community. But it didn't solve any of Tunisians' most important grievances. It didn't solve the deeper economic problems, and it hasn't done anything to improve the human rights situation in Tunisia. The only progress we've made since the revolution is freedom of expression, even though it's still threatened, and there are some institutions and state actors who try to curb it from time to time. That's, I think, one of the most important gains we've made. But does it stem from the constitution of 2014? I don't think so. When the wall of fear collapsed in December 2010 against the Ben Ali regime, it made freedom of expression more permanent. We have freedom of expression not by virtue of the constitution, but because the people are not ready, and especially the younger generations are not ready to give that away.
It's too bad that the international community only looked back at what happened, or still figuring out what happened, only after such drastic measures highlighted the struggle that we've been through all these years. Haytham, what are your thoughts about this?
In fact, there's like a huge human problem in history is the problem of belonging. We are like a group or a community, a species, and I think there's a huge question about what's democracy. Because even in the world, we can see that, for example, the UK or the Scandinavian countries and Holland and the Netherlands are monarchies, and we can find presidential democracies like in the US or in France or somewhere else. We have parliamentary democracies in Germany or in Japan. So the problem that we didn't ask ourselves the question, and even in these countries, democracy is threatened. We are seeing what's happening in the US during and after the Trump administration. And I don't know if people are aware of this, but there are a lot of terrorist attacks in the US right now, and they are so close to the Pentagon, to the Congress, and everywhere sensible and sensitive in the US. So democracy is also threatened in Europe with the alt-right and the neo-Nazism and fascism movements getting more and more hurt. The problem is people in Tunisia or in the world, they didn't resolve their local contradictions between them, because in the beginning, the notion of democracy is as they told us about the Greek origin, it's demos kratos. The problem with kratos is it means authority. It's from the beginning, there is authority of a majority over a minority. That's the problem with authority. It takes away every consensus that some people who are living together to have it. And we can see that in violence because, for example, if people are not taking the power in their hands, in their local geographical areas, in their local and regional and national decision-making and things like that, they go to violence. And I don't remember where I read this, but there is like a huge analysis of the state power, which creates the problem of machismo we're having for the male gender. It's a problem of authority that it's the complex of castration, in a way that a lot of men are violent against like women and other like weaker, between two quotation notes, men. It's because they don't belong to each other. They don't see each other as people who have the collective power over their destiny and over their choices and over their lives, literally. So I think in Tunisia, the suggestion of Kais Saied, as much as it seems so technical for me, I have a lot of precautions about it, but it's the closest form of democracy for me. It goes from the local, the individual, to the collective group in a way that it's about consensus more than authority. So for me, this is how societies evolve. There's no sacred text. There's no formula. There's no recipe. We can't cook democracy. We try to have democracy, and it evolves with every generation and with every in time and with every geographical area with the space.
What an interesting vision. Bilqis, what are your thoughts?
Thank you, Hela. First, I'd like to point out that I'm no political expert, so of course my words on whether what we have is a democracy or not are only the words of a layman. But my take is, I draw from both what Haytham and Habib said. I think to consider this, it's just a very binary vision to see that we were in a democracy and moved into being undemocratic on July 25th. You need to have the premise that it was indeed a democracy in order for us to break it, which maybe is an overstatement. There's the Western world has always seen us as an exception, and I think the vision of Tunisian exceptionalism has to fall. We were not an exception. We were not a happy democracy. I consider the hybrid transition that we had as not a fully democratic one in 2011. I think it was like a coup, a popular coup against the old regime. And we replaced that with a parliament and with a constitution, but it really failed to deliver democracy when you have a daily circus instead of a parliament, when you have few businessmen running the country and being very close to power figures and decision makers, when you have parties infiltrating the judiciary system, obfuscating files, pushing to release people like Nabil Qarawi from prison. You have like politicians calling for that and trying to get involved in every power out there. You have 10 governments in 10 years. Of course, it would fail to deliver. It's like an amateurish exercise of democracy, an attempt at being democratic, but it's just a facade. We did not change much from being a police state. Thousands are arrested every year. Just recently, we had a kid dying in prison because they did not give him his diabetes shots. We had a kid being stripped naked by the police. And we see all of this, and there's really no accountability. In the Ben Ali times, when we would see this, we would point our fingers at dictatorship. But now we can't even point our fingers because there's this facade of democracy that allows for so much impunity. We can't say the system is being unfair and acting like a dictator. We have one ruling party in every coalition, and every ruling coalition we had, the same party, they promised young people, Manish Msema, in 2017, to pass the reconciliation law on their dead bodies, and then they turned their back on us and voted in favor of it. They promised to never pass the political exclusion law. They did pass it for very, very personal interpartisan interests. Like, they wanted an opposition, so people vote more for them. So now we end up with people from the Dasturian, Al-Hizb al-Dasturi, and all regime figures in our parliament representing us, because these people decided to let them back in the power for them to be a fancy opposition, and so they could be victimized against it. And I feel like just having our political scene dictated by one party's very narrow and very personal aims is not democracy. And having a TV station owner run for president because he can influence so many people so easily is not democracy. Having some parties spending exorbitant amounts of money on campaigning and on foreign lobbying while other parties spend like close to nothing is definitely not a scene of democratic elections to me. I've been just as a young Tunisian watching this in my early 20s and wondering, is this what democracy looks like? Okay, we got freedom of speech, we got elections, we have laws, they vote on the laws, they pass or they block them. But is this what people died for, just to check the balances? We've got this check. It's a beautiful facade. It looks very appealing to the outsider eye, but the day-to-day life of a Tunisian did not change much because they failed to deliver. And that's, I could talk very long on all the economic failures, but I think just a big sign of how much they failed is that in the last few weeks, we hit highest death per capita records in the world, just because the government did not order vaccines on time, because the only government that controlled COVID was dismissed. And for narrow interests of one party, and just to being the scapegoat and the puppets of these few people and this oligarchy and this like narrow circle of businessmen who are close to these party leaders, to have them control our narrative, our future, if we're hungry, if we die, if we have oxygen in our hospitals, all of this is just dictated by a few people in power. To me, that's not democracy. Maybe the purest form of democracy is having people accomplish what they want to accomplish. And that's a realization I came to when I accepted what Qais Saied did, to see everyone in the streets, to see the numbers and the polls. I'm like, okay, if I'm a truly, purely democratic person, I don't care about the procedural democracy. I don't care about the legality of it. Maybe I just want my people to have what they want, just as another average Tunisian citizen. I should just step in the crowd instead of, you know, be in the elite that cares about, you know, what is legal, what is not legal. People don't care about what words mean. They don't care if they're called a democracy or not. I've never heard a Tunisian beside the elite care about these things. People just care about, you know, not being impoverished and not dying in hospitals because they can't breathe anymore. So I think, yeah, if I have to say if this is democratic or not, I would say that it's just the purest form of democracy to go back to what people want.
Thank you so much, Bilqis. I agree. We collectively deserve better, and the next generation deserves better. And that's why we're here talking, getting our point through, and also standing in the face of any problems that are going to happen. So really, what is left to do is wait and see and hold people accountable and never let go of it, never let go of the story. And if people from other countries will forget about this, after they've talked about it, we will not let this go, of course, and we will still be here holding the torch. To end on a lighter note, at this point, I want to give you each a minute to allow you to express yourself freely and transmit a message you want our listeners to take away from this discussion. It would also be amazing to hear any book or movie recommendations that you believe can help people understand Tunisia, be it its politics, society, history, or culture. Haytham, would you like to start?
Yeah, sure. First of all, thank you so much for this discussion. It was really thought-provoking in a way that I said things that I've never said before. So it helped me at least to assess and test some ideas with you and with myself and hopefully with the listeners afterwards. In fact, I have like two main, like we can call them big ideas, just to deal with what's happening. It's like my conclusion of the 10 years that we had, the turbulent 10 years that we had in Tunisia. First of all, my first belief is that we need to get out of technicalities in a way that there's no sacred text, there's no formula, there's no receipt. I'm repeating myself, yeah? But it needs to be repeated a lot for the people in the back. We need to bring philosophy back because that's the only human production of ideas. Because we are getting to a point that our minds are becoming some machines that don't question formulas, that don't question why and when and where and especially how. How did things come to this point? So in this perspective, the second idea that comes is to get rid of the idea of and the ideal of the Tunisian exception. In fact, we need to read and reread thoroughly history because finally, this is not an exception. This happened a lot in every other places, and there is a lot of comparison. And Tunisia is not an island in history and geography. We are interconnected to our heritage, historical heritage, and we are so connected to our geopolitical and geographical area, whether it's the Mediterranean, Africa, North Africa, the Arab world, the world, in a way. So in Tunisia, what I'm hoping for is let's build a system and fight it for the better. We don't have a system in Tunisia. We don't have like a clear system, political system, that we can agree on its minimum, possible minimum. And afterwards, we can discuss what to build on. So for recommendation, I don't really have like one book, but I really recommend that people read at least Tunisian history, if not the regional history, because it brings like a lot of ideas and a lot of analogies to reflect on every event. Because first of all, events doesn't just happen; they are created and they are the continuum of a lot of other events, and that's why I think I succeeded to predict these measures of Qais Saied. And I'm really happy about it, and I'm sharing like the happy experience just to give the idea that history and what's happening in time and in space is so important to stop with the shock and the feeling that this event is so special and is so unique and it's the first time that happens. So I hope my ideas are clear because I'm just framing them right now. And yeah, thank you.
It was a pleasure having you on this show. Habib, what are your recommendations and what is your message?
I think we should take advantage of this disruption in the transition. I will not call it democratic transition, but to redefine together the role of the state and its citizens. What's the nature of the state we want? What are the limits of its power and what rights should be inalienable for the citizens? That's something we didn't really do in 2011, in 2014, when they drafted the constitution. All the efforts supported often by the international community have focused on establishing the rules of engagement for the conflicts and power plays between members of the political economic establishment, but we haven't really changed the DNA of the old regime state. It's still the same. We don't know. I mean, it seems that Qais Saied is going to promote dramatic changes to the system. We don't know yet if he intends to do this participatively or if he plans to draft on his own a constitution and submit it to referendum or impose it. I don't know. But if I hope the process will be participatory and I hope these important questions are raised. And my book recommendation is not directly relevant to the recent events, but I think it can be interesting, an interesting read. It's called Your Sons Are at Your Service, and it was written by my good friend Aaron Zellin. Many view this book as a book about terrorism and jihadi Salafism in Tunisia. But I see it differently. I think it's the story of how the post-revolution establishment betrayed Tunisia's youth, which was instrumental to the collapse of the old regime, and how, sadly, the only organization that really addressed young people's grievances back then between 2011-2013 was a jihadi Salafi organization which was sitting outside the political system while the political parties were too focused on power sharing rather than addressing the people's needs.
Thank you. You have very thought-provoking analysis. Bilqis, you are the last one.
Yes, I'm just here to say that pluralism is not dead because it's currently on hold. And I have every faith in Tunisians not wanting to bounce back to dictatorship and every faith that eventually, hopefully, what would come out of this would not be half as bad as the static, the really static, miserable political scene we had. That really people would just couldn't wait until next elections to have a change. The change had to be immediate. I hope that it would deliver. I really hope so. I have no idea about next steps, but I'm very proud to see a lot of fellow Tunisians pushing forward their ideas, discussing, engaging in really constructive debate. It makes me happy. It makes me happy to see us this way. And I think this was a much needed time to pause and think about everything that has happened in the last decade and where we're heading next. And maybe I don't have a book recommendation. I think what people need to read the most right now is serious reporting. And I could recommend Inkifada, Mishkel, Nawet. I think they've been doing a great job lately. Otherwise, book-wise, I don't read a lot of history. As Haytham suggested, philosophy is very important. I believe it's the gymnastics of the mind. It pushes your thinking out of the box, as cliche as this sounds. But I read a lot of Hegel, and I think everyone needs to read Hegel. As much as I disagree with a lot of his points, I think he sets a good basis for thinking about philosophy of history and philosophy of politics. And just basic thinking about the foundations of civilizations and humanity.
You put that really beautifully, Bilqis, all of you. I share your feelings and I'm hopeful because of people like you, because of the things you said and because of the discussion that we can have, although we don't agree on everything, but we sit down and talk. And I hope this is also a message for our international listeners to sometimes just pause and wait and let your ear be exposed to people who are involved and to people who will be affected by the things that are happening. Thank you so much for being here, for reclaiming your narrative, and let's hope the best will happen to our country.
Thank you, Hela.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Hela, for convening us, and thank you all for this stimulating conversation.
Thank you for listening to this episode. Our guests really left us with significant takeaways and things to think about. If you want to stay tuned to what is happening in Tunisia, consider following our guests on their Twitter accounts or head over to the Activism Academy channels and let us know what you think. Your support means a lot, and we are looking forward to your input and suggestions. See you soon!